That sounds like it's working. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this helping at all? Yeah, I think I can hear. There are a lot of people in this room who have been mothers in various ways, have been our biological surrogate, adoptive, practical mothers to humans, mothers to other species. And this is a special night for you all because the topic tonight has to do with motherhood. If it ever happens that I'm becoming ununderstandable, wave at me or something. I'm recovering from a cold and my voice isn't quite under my control. Tonight, we're going to meet the Heart Sutra, some of you for the first time. And the Heart Sutra is worth meeting because it's been called by many scholars the most popular sutra in Buddhism, the most often recited sutra and mantra in Buddhism. It's also the most mysterious, enigmatic, magical, misunderstood, perhaps, sutra in Buddhism. And its popularity may have something to do with the fact that it's the shortest sutra in Buddhism. Always good. And its relationship to motherhood is that it's about the mother of all the Buddhas, Prajnaparamita. So literally, we're not going to go into a lot of deep study and intellectual torture tonight. We're going to actually meet her. It'll be like me saying, here, I'd like you to meet this teacher, Prajnaparamita, and you'll say, hi, glad to meet you. And it's going to be kind of like that. It should be light and fun. Her role in Buddhism is as the mother of all the Buddhas, similar to the role of Mary in the Christian tradition, the mother of Jesus, namely the mother of the divinity, kind of an important job. And Sophia in ancient Israel, who was the mother of, or the goddess of, wisdom. And there's a close link with Sophia because Prajnaparamita is wisdom in Buddhism. So this story begins with a story. Pat Hennessy, Frank Ostaseski, my wife Carol and I, among some tens of thousands of other people, went to a teaching on the Heart Sutra in May of 2001 with the Dalai Lama. And it was at Shoreline Auditorium south of San Francisco. It was like a rock concert in many ways. Thousands of people from all over the world. It was really fascinating. One of the biggest contingents were Chinese from Taiwan and Hong Kong and Singapore. Many people from every other continent. Large translation booths set up where people could get headsets for instantaneous translation. And the biggest of the booths were for the Chinese dialects. Which is fitting, actually, because this is a Chinese creation. And just a brief bit of fascinating history. It's a creation built of Indian parts, assembled in China, and transferred to the rest of the world in a bewildering array of forms. In the US alone, where in almost all Zen sanghas and many Tibetan sanghas and a lot of other sanghas, it's chanted every day. Even in Zen, there's hundreds of different versions of it, as far as little bits of changes in the wording, but the core is the same in all of them. It's not recited in the root lineage that formed Spirit Rock or Insight Meditation Society that a lot of our teachers have come from, because it's clearly not a direct teaching of the Buddha. And the Theravadin earlier lineages try to restrict themselves to texts which are probably at least related to a teaching the Buddha gave. This is a development of the Buddha's teachings, basically. The Buddha taught for 45 years, died about 450 years before our current era, and his wisdom teachings had to do with something called anatman, non-self, where in a variety of discourses he showed that the elements that make up the self, called the skandhas or the aggregates, are in every moment arising, changing, resolving. And so when he could prove that that was the case through his own investigation and his logical teachings, it was clear that there is no such thing as a master commander of what we call the self. In fact, there's not really such a thing as the self. So within a few hundred years of the Buddha's death, a natural evolution of that took place, where people started to realize two things. One is that if that's true for the self, it's probably true for everything else that's comprised of elements. And so the teachings on shunyata, the emptiness of all things, the emptiness of the intrinsic nature or absolute existence of all things, started to arise. And somewhere between 100 years before the current era and 100 years after the start of the current era, two major concepts had been established, the concept of emptiness and the concept of the bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is one who frees all beings. The bodhisattva vow is that you vow to stick around and keep going through rebirth and the cycle of existence until you are assured that all beings can be liberated. And we'll actually look at the bodhisattva ideal and the bodhisattva vow in 2 weeks. And this teaching arose from that. So the literature that was arising in India in the end of maybe 400 years after the Buddha, and then the next couple hundred years, was called the Prajnaparamita literature. It was the literature on this emptiness and bodhisattva ideal. And there was a steady flow of Chinese scholars coming to India, starting just a couple hundred years after the Buddha's death, and taking this, all of the literature, all of the sutras, and all of this developing stuff back to China, where it was being translated into Chinese, and then eventually on to other countries in Asia. And then Buddhism went into a decline in India, and essentially by the 1100s disappeared. And then the flow of information started coming from China back to India, for the few Buddhists who were trying to resurrect Buddhism in India. But this is a Chinese invention, put together by all of the bits and pieces, actually 500 different versions of the Prajnaparamita literature, which was voluminous, 100,000 words per sutra. This one is just a few words. So why should it meet the Sandpoint Sangha? Well, we're a pretty unique group, even in American Buddhism. We're this amalgam of people from all of the religious traditions of the U.S., plus probably some agnostics and some atheists and maybe even some Buddhists. But we're using the teachings of the Buddha because he developed this wonderful science of mind, which isn't tainted by religious dogma. And we find that very helpful. We're also guided by the teachings of two really important people, the Dalai Lama, who says, please don't convert. Just use these teachings as best you can. You can certainly become a Buddhist if you want. There's no prohibition on that, but the Sangha is not pushing that agenda. And then Jack Kornfield, who said, please don't import sectarian differences from Asia to the US. We're not trying to put together a Sangha that's just representing one tradition from Asia. Jack Kornfield said, instead of Hinayana and Mahayana and Vajrayana, let's just call it the Buddhayana and use what works. I really respect that point of view. So with that preamble, let's meet the Prajnaparamita. We have a bunch of massive handouts tonight. My wife feels like I'm becoming excessive compulsive. She's probably right. The one that's stapled together, we'll pass this both ways, is a study packet. We're not going to go into this in gory detail tonight, but for those of you who are interested, I've put together my own little explanation and notes, and any error is totally my own. Jim and Linda graciously spent time going through it. They found that I couldn't count to six and that I left out one of the most important things I should have put in. Those two things at least are corrected. Also, we have two other pages to pass out that are going to remain separate. One of them is the mantra that goes with this sutra, and several versions of the interpretation of the mantra. And the other is the Plum Village practice page, because I chose as our version of the Heart Sutra the one that Thich Nhat Hanh did in September of 2014, just fairly soon before his stroke. And it's not only in memory of Thich Nhat Hanh, who luckily is still alive and recovering, but it's also one of the most beautiful. So you have a practice page with the dedicated to the mantra and a practice page dedicated to the sutra should you ever decide you want to recite the sutra in a group. Thich Nhat Hanh's group recites the sutra daily. I think that's a bit excessive. But at least you can have a concise form of it. So while it's passing out is going along, you see a new statue in the middle of the room. And this is the Bodhisattva who is represented as giving us this teaching. This is in India, Avalokiteshvara, who's depicted mostly in male form. But most of the world depicts the Bodhisattva of actually compassion and loving kindness as Kuan Yin in China, Kanon in Japan, also known as Kanzion, you've probably heard her as that, and some of the manifestations of Tara. And so that's her, that's the one who is the Bodhisattva of compassion, the Bodhisattva of loving kindness, and she's giving us this teaching. So we are to understand that even though this is a teaching about wisdom, this is wisdom inextricably in union with loving kindness and compassion. And that's very important. This is not wisdom here, this is wisdom here. So the title page is only a very few of the titles. The Prajnaparamita. Prajna is wisdom, as many of you know. Paramita means perfection, so this is about the perfection of wisdom, meaning that wisdom is taken from here to the actual direct experience of it, which is in union with compassion and loving kindness. And this very short sutra and even shorter mantra are designed to pick you up and take you there. In fact, many people would be appalled that anyone ever tries to interpret the mantra, because actually this mantra is something called a dhyani, which just is supposed to magically move you towards this, according to the beliefs of many Buddhists. But because we're Americans, and we want to know what's happening, many attempts at interpreting it have been made. We'll get to that later. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the Heart Sutra, which is a fairly direct translation of the original Chinese version, which was finalized about 1,200 years ago. But I've added as an epilogue the edition made by the Tibetans, because it says a couple things that are really important. One is, this kind of wisdom is indescribable, inconceivable, and inexpressible, which explains why the Buddha didn't want to teach after he had his enlightenment. The legend is that he only agreed to teach after the gods and goddesses pleaded with him to give it a try, to share it with the rest of us. And then the last line of this, I pay homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times, meaning that this teaching is the mother of all the Buddhas. You can't become a Buddha until you actually get what's being transmitted in this, which is that particular kind of deep wisdom, which is the combination of emptiness and compassion inextricably bound together. Again, though, if you find any of this confusing, just take pleasure in the first three words, because it's indescribable, inconceivable, and inexpressible. Not a single word I say tonight will be true. They're all just trying to point at something which is totally ineffable. And then the whole sutra is just words trying to point at something which is ineffable, meaning not describable. The rest of this prologue, the perfection of sublime knowing. Sublime knowing, in this terminology, is getting emptiness. And that takes a long time, in fits and starts. The perfection of knowing emptiness is prajnaparamita, is this moving it from here to here and experiencing the compassion and loving kindness that's part of it. And that's the beginning of your path, the bodhisattva stages and becoming a Buddha. Unborn and unceasing just means that it's not something that's created or able to be destroyed. It's primordial, it a priori, exists before anything else and after everything else. The very nature of space means that it's just everywhere at all times, can't be diminished, can't be expanded. The realm of your own self-knowing timeless awareness reminds us that it is our own nature. We're not trying to get anything, we're trying to recognize our own true nature. And this is one of the most famous processes in the world for doing that, working with the Heart Sutra and its mantra. A couple things about the text. This is the same text that's in that one-page sutra from Thich Nhat Hanh. And, we've got this a little bit different here. The epilogue should go as page 4. Let's see. So, page 2, let's see where I am. No, I've got this. I'm reading it backwards. Sorry, Gina, you've got it perfectly right, and I'm totally confused. It starts, this is not a new thing either.
So the Heart Sutra starts with Avalokiteshvara, her, Kuan Yin, Kanzeon, the Bodhisattva. And the insight that brings us to the other shore is just this, what we've been talking about, Prajnaparamita, the perfection of sublime knowing. And what isn't in Thich Nhat Hanh's version is the way this traditionally starts. Shariputra, Buddha's leading disciple, and one who was authorized to become a teacher while the Buddha was still alive, asks her in an assembly of people, he asks her, Avalokiteshvara, how does any son or daughter of spiritual heritage proceed who wishes to perfect the wisdom? Those aren't the exact words, but so he asks the question, stimulating the answer, which is the Heart Sutra. Mm-hmm. And then...
Was that the Buddha who said that, or mm-hmm. the disciple of Buddha?
The disciple of the Buddha, Shariputra. Okay. One of his two most famous male disciples. There were two famous men, two famous women. The legend is he asked Kuan Yin, tell us, how does any son or daughter in the spiritual path proceed who wants to uncover this? And she answers with the Heart Sutra. The Buddha is in the longer version, slightly longer, that the Tibetans and the Mongolians use, where it's a complicated three-way thing that Thich Nhat Hanh cuts to the chase and even leaves it even simpler. Anyway, a few terms. All of these are in the notes. The five skandhas are those five things that make up the human being that the Buddha proved were constantly changing, constantly arriving and going away, and so there couldn't really possibly be a solid, independent, permanent self, even though we feel like there's one. And the Buddha also proved through his teachings that this sense of being someone who's in charge of my body, in charge of what's going on with my body, is also false. And we've gone actually through a few of those little exercises to tear down that concept. The Buddha was so interested in tearing down this idea of an individual self, because it was clear to him after enlightenment that that's the whole root of suffering. We have this sense of an individual separate self. We respond to everything that arises with erroneous beliefs based on like it, don't like it, want it, don't want it, push it away, grab it to us. Basically, we respond to everything with clinging or aversion that guarantees our suffering. So the Buddha saw that when we can get past this mental error, this mental-emotional error, that we are a separate, individual, permanent self, then we get to the root of suffering and sever it. So that's the Buddhist term of skandhas. So he's saying, listen, Shariputra, she's saying, listen, Shariputra, the body itself is emptiness. The form, body, is the first skanda. If we go up to line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is the important one. All of these skandas, all of these elements which make up an individual self, are empty of self nature. They're empty of being how they appear. They are empty of all of our beliefs and habitual patterns about them. They're empty of anything you can cling to. The trouble with the word empty in English is it denotes nothing. Nothingness, nil, void. But it's the opposite of that. It's that these things, it's so far beyond the way they appear. Boundless. Instead of this thing being empty of boldness in a negative way, what emptiness means is it's far, far beyond that. It's infinitely beyond that. Boldness is such a tiny part of this that our concept of bold is totally inadequate. The relative truth is that this is a bowl and it sounds as a gong. And the view of emptiness is in no way trying to dispute that or argue with it or say it's not so. In the relative sense, absolutely a gong. But in the absolute sense, it's so much beyond that, that our attempts to categorize it and then habitually grasp or push away its boldness or anything else in the universe is such an error that it locks us into this cycle of ignorance and suffering. So this whole sutra and all of the teachings on emptiness and the bodhisattva ideal are to free us from that. So the only thing I'll warn you about here is that the word emptiness is one I think is too confusing to use. And yet most versions of the Heart Sutra, and this one, uses emptiness. It's very important to realize that when you study Sanskrit, you see that shunyata, the ta is actually a separate root in Sanskrit. Shunya means the empty nature of things, their boundlessness. And ta means knowing. So shunyata means knowing the empty nature of things. So emptiness means knowing the empty nature. Emptiness is not a thing. It's not a place. It's not a source. It's not like God or the universe or Buddha nature. It's not a thing. It's simply a description. So every time in English we run into the word emptiness, we think it's a noun, we think it's a thing, we're led that way, but it's not. It's a description of the ultimate nature and the ultimate way in which something exists, which is boundless, way beyond anything we can grasp.
Yes? Substitute spaciousness for emptiness?
Spaciousness works. A bit more accurate is boundless, boundlessness. Because it's way beyond any of our concepts about it. It's so far beyond that it's not graspable, either mentally or in our usual habitual patterns of grasping or pushing away. So it frees us from grasping or pushing away when we understand it. And that's the key to understanding emptiness, is it leads to total freedom from our habitual patterns that cause suffering. But the word itself in English makes us suffer more because we struggle with it so much. So wherever you can, recreate it in your mind, just to remember that it's an adjective. So when we get to a line like emptiness itself is this body, you can basically work with it and say, this body is also the empty nature of things. The empty nature of things also includes this body, that kind of thing. It's always a description. It is never a thing. If you remember that, you won't get in trouble. If you start to think of it as a thing, it'll get you stuck. In May of 2001, the Dalai Lama spent, I think, a whole day trying to tell us that emptiness wasn't a thing. It was mind-numbing at times. I may go through my notes. So I think the rest of this is fairly much something you can work from the notes. She goes through, Guan Yin goes through, showing that all of the various aggregates are empty of self-nature. And then all phenomena are empty of self-nature. Birth is empty of self-nature. Death is empty of self-nature. Being is empty of self-nature. Non-being. Defilement, purity, increasing, decreasing. So not only are the skandhas empty of self-nature, but the 18 realms of phenomena, which are all the sense faculties, eyes, ears, nose, throat, mouth, all of the sense, all of the chain that comes from actual visual contact through the eye, all the way to the mental processing of it. Every step of the way we perceive the universe is empty of self-nature. It's all a process. It's all interrelated. And this is the important one at the bottom of page 2. The 12 links of interdependent arising mean basically interdependence, the cause and effect nature of everything. The original teachings in India and China on this were that if you get interdependence, you get emptiness. So interdependence is really crucial. And the next line, and their extinction, meaning you can really help yourself by getting both interdependence and impermanence. If you really focus your, if you narrow down your focus on what are called the wisdom teachings, on understanding interdependence and understanding impermanence, you don't really have to worry about emptiness. You get there. Okay. So the bottom of page 2, interdependence and impermanence. And the book that I recommend at the very back of this, Thich Nhat Hanh's little book, it's on the bottom of page 6 of 6. No, it's not. Where did it go? Oh, no, it's on the bottom of the mantra page. We'll get to it. Anyway, he has a little 54-page book called The Heart of Understanding. It's short, it's small, it's the clearest language I have ever seen explaining interdependence, impermanence, and emptiness. And in the literature, in the modern literature about the Heart Sutra, that book is referred to as the thing that changed everything. It just made it so simple that we don't have to beat our heads against the wall. But another reason that it's good to just get some introduction to this Heart Sutra is that Kirill has agreed to start teaching us the Heart Sutra mantra, and we'll go into that tonight. And it's really worth knowing what the mantra is tied to and why the mantra is said. So you can, if you wish, and are feeling masochistic, go through the text and all of my little numbers and notes, or you can just say, okay, I've been introduced to the Heart Sutra, and now I'll learn the mantra. One other thing I want to say about all of this is that on page 4 is also the Tibetan closing of this, which they added, and I include it because it reminds us that not only are we paying homage, in this case, to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but we're paying homage to the Supreme Mother, the Mother of all the Buddhas, the perfection of sublime knowing. And then the Tibetan version ends, and may my words, and may these words of truth be accomplished. Yeah, that's enough for the sutra tonight. We'll talk about the mantra, but are there any questions about the sutra?
I have a question. So the Buddha was a real human being, a real person, and he had a disciple who was a real person.
Yes.
And this disciple asked Avalokiteshvara
this question.
Was there a real person, a real woman who answered, or was this a divine revelation? How did that happen?
It's a good question. Most people can't give you a straight answer on that for the reason that in order to make sutras and scriptures seem authentic, they were all credited to the Buddha. Even this one, when you go into the wording other than Thich Nhat Hanh's, has the Buddha sitting there in meditation. Through his meditative powers, the Buddha induces Shariputra to ask the question of Avalokiteshvara, and Avalokiteshvara channels the Buddha's answer. So it's very convoluted, all, I think, in an attempt to get credibility. Yes, this is from the Buddha. Actually, this wonderful scholar named Jan Natier, she's just a genius, and she was one of many people who spent years trying to figure this all out. And she came up with the conclusion that there's no way the Buddha taught this in its present form or anywhere close to its present form. The Prajnaparamita literature started cropping up as a natural development of the Buddha's teachings on Anatman, hundreds of years after the Buddha died. I personally think the Buddha knew we were going to go this way, but there was only a limit to how much he could teach. But obviously, he experienced this in his enlightenment. He just chose not to teach everything he experienced. That's my own feeling on this. Because obviously, he experienced what's being called the mother of all the Buddhas.
But he did experience boundlessness, emptiness.
He did. No way he couldn't have. Yeah. It's just that he didn't choose to teach it in that form. He taught it indirectly as myself, knowing that we would, over time, develop that further. There's no way it can't keep developing. If the Buddha arrived today instead of 2,500 years ago, his teachings would look a lot different, talking about the same enlightenment in completely different words. But in direct answer to your question, nobody knows whether there was an actual person behind any of these beings like Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin. It's thought that, yes, there have been many bodhisattvas. Many people continue to take the bodhisattva vow. The Dalai Lama, among others, administers it. But these representations of bodhisattvas have been sanded and hewn and specialized so that one represents loving kindness and compassion, another represents wisdom, another represents cutting through obstacles, another represents hearing the cries of suffering of the beings in the world and responding. So each bodhisattva represents a different aspect of our own enlightened being, probably not an actual person. Each bodhisattva is a mirror of our own true nature and one of its characteristics. Any other questions about the sutra or anything we've said so far? So for the purposes of the recording, I forgot to repeat Carol's question. Was there an actual woman named Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin? And Pat answered that beautifully. Everything is really transmitted to us with "thus I have heard." And so things elaborate in their telling and retelling over 2,500 years. And again, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the pantheon of Buddhism represent innate qualities of our own enlightened mind. And it is thought in Judaism and in Buddhism that wisdom is feminine, and in Hinduism, and actually in Islam as well. Not so sure about the Christian tradition there as far as wisdom goes. I think we adopted Sophia to some extent in some of the mystic traditions, but I don't know anything about it. So do you all have the mantra page?
No,
I have a mantra page. Yes. This is the one that Carol and Linda and others will be passing out for newcomers and for those of us who have lost ours. And, the mantra itself, totally simple. Gate, gate, para gate, para sangate, bodhisattva. Or Svaha, depending on how you hear it. And I've given three explanations. They aren't truly translations because most scholars say it's not translatable. But I put these in order of progression. The Dalai Lama likes go, go, go beyond, go totally beyond, be rooted in the ground of enlightenment. An Indian scholar said more accurate use of the Sanskrit is going, going, going beyond, arriving completely beyond. And Thich Nhat Hanh says gone, gone all the way over, everyone gone to the other shore. Two other common examples use the word arrive or arriving. I personally prefer the ones that indicate process, going, arriving, because that's the truth of being a practitioner. This is a process, a developmental process. There's maybe one person a century who just gets it and is gone, and the rest of us are going. And so my preference is either going or arriving. But you choose. Again, these are made-up English explanations for what can't be explained. And the truth of it, the way these are transmitted in traditional Buddhism, is that just the chanting of it has some energetic effect on us that helps open the channels and allow us to understand more. Whether you believe that or not, it's a very nice chant.
Yeah.
And one thing that's crucial is that in Buddhism, you know, among Buddhists who use this mantra, it's really important to dedicate it. So at the end of finishing the repetitions of the mantra and before going home, you say something in your own language or whatever you want, and silently or aloud, I dedicate this mantra, this recitation of the mantra, to the awakening of all beings, or for the awakening of all beings. Something to the point that you're not doing this for yourself. Again, the Bodhisattva ideal is working for the enlightenment of everybody. And this mantra especially is considered sacred enough that you don't keep it for yourself. You always, at some point on finishing it, dedicate it for the benefit of all. And that's considered an important part of the mantra. Again, whether you all decide as you use this to do it silently with your own little dedication or to use some formal dedication, and there's a page of formal dedication and aspiration prayers from our 3-day retreat that you could refer to. Some form of saying, may the benefits of reciting this mantra go for the awakening of all beings. Any questions about the mantra? I turn it over to Carol.
Hey, I hadn't heard it sung. In fact, I chat with someone weekly, and we had said together, there must be a Heart Sutra mantra, and we didn't know it, so we made one up. So we have one that we did. And then I went online and I listened to a number of them, including a rap version by MC Yogi and kind of a real Zen version where everything is like this. And it was cool after a while. You know, I like that too. And this is yet another one I found online. And I thought it was really nice. So I thought maybe we'd start with it. And once we get really grounded in it, we could play with different ones. No, but we'll get grounded in this so we don't confuse ourselves. And then, you know, it's just really nice to open to different versions. And so let's recite it twice, just reading it. And each together, and each syllable will have a full count. So let's do it together. Gahe, gahe. Paragate, parasangate, bodhisattva. Again, maybe a little faster. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisattva. And I'll sing the tune and then we can all do it together.
Carol, just one thing.
Yes.
Almost, I don't think I've heard an exception. The A is soft. Para.
Para.
So, mm-hmm.
Para, yeah. Yeah, I was just, okay, all right. And when we chant, I'm sure it will be.
Yeah.
So here's the chant. Gate, gate, para gate, para sam gate, bodhisattva.
Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate,
Bodhisattva. You must just do it a few times. Let me see if I have it right. Gate, gate, para gate, para sangate. I feel like I don't have it right, but sorry, everybody. We'll get it. Okay. Gate, gate, parasangate, parasangate, bodhisattva. Gate, gate, parasangate, parasangate.